I don't know why I keep thinking of the Lone Ranger, the masked man. Well, brother, have you ever found yourself in the rubble and smoldering smoke of sin, wondering how it was that you came to this place? No matter what the sin, the discouragement, the damage that occurs is something that we despise and that we wish to avoid. Chances are, we got to that place through the path of temptation. Today we're going to talk about temptation, about saying no to temptation, even when we may want to say yes. Starting my watch here. There are a series of steps that we can follow that will help us to begin to make progress against those things that tempt us and bring us into sin. To begin, let's start with at least a bit of a definition. Turn with me, if you would, to 1 Timothy 6, in verses 8 and 9. 1 Timothy 6, verses 8 and 9. I think we all know what we mean when we say temptation. We've been tempted. We've been drawn. We've been seduced, we might say. We've been solicited. Notice what 1 Timothy 6 in verses 8 and 9 tell us. Paul first tells Timothy, if we have food and, New American Standard says, covering, obviously here in the New King James, food and clothing. The reason I read New American Standard, it says we have food and covering. Put face in front of that. It says be content, right? If we have food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Now that is hard of and by itself. Hard for me to be content with, what do you mean, no house, no car, be content with just food and clothing? Maybe if food includes ice cream, I could deal with this, right? Be content. Then it goes on to say, but those who desire to be rich fall into what? Temptation. Temptation. Seems to be temptation is something you fall into, at least the way Paul describes it here. The desire to be rich. Now, we could make a sermon out of that. Who desires to be rich? Well, the poor. The middle class, yeah, probably. Even the rich desire to be richer. Very few people I've ever heard that have said, you know, I have more money than I know what to do with. I just got so much money, I'm just kind of throwing it out the window when I drive down the street to help somebody else out. I don't know what to do with all this money. No one says that. It's always the next best thing that's needed. So anyone can be in that situation where the desire to get rich, those who want to get rich, it says, fall into temptation. And then it says, and a snare. So the desire to get rich is a snare, but let's look at this word temptation. It's the Greek word perasmos. And literally, the definition says, a putting to proof by experiment of good, experience of evil. So it's a kind of a test. That's an interesting aspect to temptation, that God does not eliminate temptation from our life because it can be a test for us. And a test is not an evil thing. A test is not a bad thing. When I give tests in the Survey of the Gospels class, it's not, well, maybe it is evil. Gavin saying, yeah, it's evil. Gavin Victoria saying, no, it's not evil. It's a test to say, how are you doing? So God does allow temptation. It is a test. The definition goes on, solicitation. Now we're getting to the use of the word temptation that we normally think about. It's temptation. It's a solicitation. A solicitation to what? To do something that is not godly, to do something that is wrong. It's a solicitation or provocation. It's an interesting, you're being provoked. You're being tempted. Think fishing. What do you put on a hook? You don't just throw a hook into the water. Well, in most cases, right? You bait it. You put something that's provoking whatever you're trying to catch to come take a bite. Provocation, temptation. So key concepts as we begin to draw out of this word temptation is that it is a test. In other words, it will come to all of us. Temptation will happen. And it is a solicitation to do wrong, to do evil, to let down. It's an influence. It's a provocation. In other words, we're being drawn towards something that is illegal or incorrect or wrong. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 3. We'll go through the initial temptation, we might say, that was foisted upon the human race by Satan the devil. And we'll find that that is always the case. Temptation's origin are from Satan the devil. We'll read later that God never tempts. He never solicits us to do wrong. He never puts things in front of us to cause us to be drawn to evil. That is Satan's way of operating. Genesis 3 and verse 1, you remember the story. The serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field. It's interesting, God is never described as cunning. Now, we might say he was a cunning man, and maybe in the sense that those fellows that built the tabernacle, it literally says they were cunning artificers. They were crafty individuals, figuring out how to make all these things that went into the tabernacle. But God is not described as cunning in this sense of kind of crafty, sneaky. Serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made. And he said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree in the garden?" We find that in temptation, there's a number of factors that we can identify. And oftentimes in temptation, there is an injection of doubt. And it seems like an innocent question. Maybe that's the way it came across to Eve to begin with. Has God really said? Has he indeed said? The New American Standard says, has God really said? I mean, is that what he said? Now, Satan knew this is not what God said, in my judgment. But he's leading. It's almost like a used car salesman. There's this leading question. And salesmen know that you ask questions in the start of a negotiation process to what? Get people to say yes. You get them to say yes. So you ask them, hey, have you been looking long? Yes or no or what? You try to get them to say yes. Would you like a new car? Well, yes. Our daughter and son-in-law are in the market for a new car. And because two car seats and a booster seat just don't fit in the vehicle that they have now. And for some reason, they refuse to drive a minivan. There's just pride, you know. So they're looking for a vehicle, and they made an appointment yesterday to go down and look at one that had all the specs that they were looking for. And so they drove down to Canton, actually, to take a look at this car. And they got there and said, "Oh, sorry, we sold it last night. But we've got this other one here. We know you need a car. You need a car, right, to fit all those car seats?" "Oh, yes." Now, they didn't bite, but the point was drawing. "Can we come down and take a test drive?" "Well, sure." Well, what he didn't tell them is that the car that you wanted to test drive isn't here anymore. So used car salesmen do have this reputation as liars and cheats. And sometimes it seems to be justified. So Satan leads it with these questions. Did God really say that? To get this conversation going. But it's the doubt that's injected. Had God really said? I mean, isn't that being a little unreasonable? Has God really said that? Now, Eve, innocently enough, maybe, says, "Oh," the woman said to the serpent, "we may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden. But," you see, "it's only one fruit. It's the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden. God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." Now, we could analyze her statement a little more closely. That's not our point for today. But what he begins to do is introduce human reasoning. Rather than accepting what God said, he introduces human reasoning. He says in verse 4, "Then the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die.'" No, that's not true. Human reason. Think about it for a minute. I mean, why on earth would God give you all this garden to eat and then tell you you can't eat that one? I mean, think this through. You're a smart lady. You got a lot on the ball. You were created last week. I don't know what Satan said. But the point is, come on, think this through. Use your head. Don't let them kid you. There's something else going on here. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened." And she starts to apparently think, well, yeah, why did God say not to eat that? What's the big deal about that one tree? What's he withholding? What's he holding back from me? So, injection of doubt, and then human reason. Don't just accept what God has said. Reason it through for yourself. And you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So we might say there's a third aspect there of appealing to vanity. Temptation almost always has one or more of these factors in the middle of it. Injection of doubt. Is it really going to be that bad? I mean, what are the consequences of this after all? Sure, I'm going to eat that fifth jelly donut, but come on. I got a digestive system. It'll take care of it. Didn't Christ say, you know, all things are clean? I can eat what I want. So we got this human reasoning starting to go, and then the appeal to vanity. I can make my own decisions. I'm my own man. I'm my own woman. I don't have to listen to that. So, verse 6, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, looked attractive, isn't it true that in temptation, there is almost always something that appears to be attractive, appears to be good. It says she saw it was a delight to her eyes, is literally what the Hebrew says. It was pleasant to the eye. It was a delight to the eye. It looked awesome. So you combine these factors of injecting doubt in God's word, human reasoning, figuring it out for yourself. Don't listen to what God says. Use your brain. You're a human. You can do this. And how much of sin in our culture, in our world, has to do with, look, make your own decision. You're an automaton just following God and these words. Can you imagine what Satan must have said to these demons? You're all just going to follow him? Come on, use your minds. You're sharp. You're brilliant people. You're brilliant beings. Come on, use your mind. He's holding back from us. He's keeping us from our potential, et cetera, et cetera. Who knows all what he must have said. But she saw that it was a tree desirable to make one wise. At least that's not what she was convinced of, even though it was wrong. She took of its fruit and ate. And she gave to her husband with her, and he ate. And you know the rest of the story. But let's look at this scenario. Injection of doubt, human reason, appeal to vanity, attractiveness, and it combines into lust, which leads to sin. Notice these elements in Matthew chapter 4. Matthew chapter 4, Satan has not changed his method of operation at all. Think in your life of recent temptations. Is it possible that some of these same factors were appealing to you, drawing at you, injection of doubt? I mean, what's the big deal? Why is it such a, surely it can't be that bad. If I look at this, if I eat that, if I do this, if I say this. Christ's example here is quite a contrast to Eve's. But notice the elements of temptation. Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Again, tempted also has a degree of tested. Mr. Armstrong often used to write about this temptation of Christ. And as he successfully overcame each of these temptations, and when I teach the survey of the Gospels, we talk about what do each of these temptations represent as far as general principles of life. What do human beings have to resist or reject from Satan to be able to be successful? I don't have time to talk about those things now. But when Mr. Armstrong would write about this, this was the time that Christ actually, quote unquote, qualified to be ruler of the kingdom of God. and displace Satan because he successfully beat back these temptations and qualified by defeating Satan. Now, he didn't take office at that moment, just as David didn't take office the moment he was ordained or anointed to be king. He went through a period of time. Christ would go back to heaven and spend a few thousand years before he will return. He still yet has not claimed this throne that he owns. But nonetheless, he was tempted by the devil. When he'd fasted 40 days and 40 nights afterward, he was hungry. That, of course, is an understatement, to say the least. He must have been famished. Different commentators will look at this and say, well, fasting must have been like the fasting the Pharisees did. They did not eat anything, but they did drink liquids. And maybe that's the kind of fast Christ had. It's very possible that it was a miraculous fast, because normally 40 days you wouldn't live if you did not drink something during that time. You could go without food for that period of time. You'd be very weak, but you could go without food. So was that the kind of fast, or was this an absolute stunning miracle that Christ did not eat or drink for 40 days, and he was alive, he was strong, he was healthy, he was weak, he was very hungry? That may be the case. I don't know that I'd argue that with anyone necessarily. Obviously, the Bible says when there's a spiritual fast, we fast without food and without drink. When the Pharisees, for example, said, look, we fast twice in the week. They didn't eat food, but they did drink during the day. So when that's the case, again, I wouldn't argue this with people necessarily. I lean to the side that this is a spectacular miracle, but that's my opinion. Verse 3, now when, notice how Satan is described, when the tempter came, part of Satan's nature is that he strives to solicit sin, to draw us into sin, to provoke us into sin, to influence us into sin. So when you feel temptation, please remember where it's coming from. It is a direct attack on you and your character, and on God, frankly, by Satan the devil himself. So the tempter came to him and said, if you are the Son of God. Well, there's a challenge there, obviously, but he didn't intend it necessarily as an outright challenge. It was more of a doubt. If you are the Son of God, command that these stones be made to bread. Use your head. You are starving. Think it through yourself. Don't just blindly follow. Think it through yourself. You've got a brain in your head. Come on. Turn these stones into bread. So you've got injection of doubt. Are you really the Son of God? You've got human reason. Think this through. You've got a need to eat. This appeal to vanity. You can do this, can't you? It's almost like, if you can do this, sure, I bet you can't. In essence, that's what he said. I bet you really can't. If you are the Son of God, command these stones be turned to bread. And I would imagine if I were Jesus Christ at this point, or I had fasted even a day or two or three, would these stones look awfully tasty if we could turn them into bread? That's very attractive, absolutely. Christ, of course, stamps that down immediately. He answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. He was not going to step in that direction at all. Because we sometimes ask the question, would it have been sin for Christ to turn this stone into bread? Would that have been sin? I mean, it's no sin to eat, right? But he didn't. Why? Well, one of the things I think is a reasonable explanation. He didn't want to. Wasn't even going to start stepping in that direction. Wasn't even going to go there at all. It's like the used car salesman getting you to say yes. Do you love that new car smell? Who's going to say, well, no, I actually, unless they've got environmental illnesses, you know, they're going to say, oh, I love that new car smell. Apparently, someone told me that at Walmart there's this aerosol spray can in the auto department that is just labeled new car smell. So you could take it in your old car, I guess, spray it around, and you'll be okay. Christ wasn't even going to step in that direction to start that process. Verse 5, the devil took him up into the holy city by vision, obviously, set him on the pinnacle of the temple. And again, the pinnacle of the temple, one of the highest points overlooking probably the Valley of Hinnom. A huge drop, some say 270 feet or more down into the valley. So where the temple wall was built right on the edge of the valley, said to him, if you're the Son of God, same thing, throw yourself down. Now, there's an injection of doubt. I don't really think you're the Son of God. If you are, throw yourself down. Attempting to cause Christ to doubt, we might say, challenging that doubt, challenging the vanity. If you're the Son of God, throw yourself down. For it is written, and he misquotes Scripture, he shall give his angels charge over you. Does that mean we jump off, you know, the building? Remember your mother saying that? Well, if your friends jumped off a building, would you follow them? You know. And in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. I mean, use your head. If you're the Son of God, show yourself. Show me. Ever have a temptation that way? Show me. Come on. Prove it. Prove to me that you are what you say you are. So human reason. Don't accept what God has said. Show it now. Was part of God's plan, Christ throwing himself off the edge of this building to prove that the angels would carry him back. Angels are given charge, you know, human reason. Attractiveness, this appeal to vanity. Imagine how you'll look when you jump off the edge and all these angels rush to catch you and bring you back up. This appeal to vanity, so often a part of temptation. Satan has found effective methods of solicitation, of influence, of provocation, of tempting. And he will use that formula over and over and over again, often against us. So knowing that oftentimes injection of doubt, human reason, appeal to vanity, attractiveness of eyesight, this issue of it looks so good and what sin does not have, an attractive side to it. I mean, otherwise it wouldn't be attractive. No one would be attracted to it. You combine those things, they generate lust. That lust leads to action. That action is sin. So knowing that is the case, how do we deal with temptation? What steps can we take to resist temptation, to reject what is wrong and do what is right? I've got five quick steps I think we can go through that I hope will be helpful. They certainly are for me, and I hope they will be for you as well. First thing to acknowledge is number one, acknowledge it's me. When we talk about how to deal with temptation, realize the problem is me. We must acknowledge that when we fall to temptation and sin, we cannot place the blame on others. You know, I wouldn't have got so mad if you weren't so stupid. You've heard something like that? I wouldn't have got so mad if that guy hadn't tailgated me for the last 3 miles. You know, I wouldn't have got so angry or upset. Wouldn't be so mad if you would have helped with the dishes. Or if you would have done your job. If you would have trimmed that bush the way I asked you to 4 years ago. It's somebody else's fault that I've sinned. It's not my fault. No, we are the problem. We can't place the blame on other circumstances. The air conditioning was broke at work, and so that's why I was so angry. That's why I was so upset. That's why I stormed out of the office or whatever it might be. We can't blame Satan. We can't blame our boss. We can't blame our kids. We can't blame our parents. We can't blame the television. We can't blame the internet, the ease of access to all those things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is us. We are the problem. We need to quit blaming others and acknowledge that giving in to temptation points to a spiritual flaw in me, a weakness of character in me. We acknowledge that before God. James chapter 1. James chapter 1. We referred to this scripture earlier. We'll read it now. James talks about temptation in James 1, verse 13. Let no one say when he is tempted, and that's that phrase of being provoked, being drawn toward sin as if it's an invisible force like steel to a magnet. Let no one say when he's drawn in that way, tempted, I am tempted by God. God put this temptation in front of me. God doesn't do that, James says, for God cannot, number one, be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. Now, he allows temptation to exist, and as we said earlier, there's that aspect of testing. So God could remove all temptation, but he realizes that it's good for us to learn how to resist that draw, to build the spiritual strength through the power of God's Spirit to resist those temptations, so that one day we can be like God. Because it says here, God cannot be tempted by evil. There is absolutely no draw at all on God for anything evil. There's just no draw. There's no magnetism there. There's no connection whatsoever. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have that situation where whatever temptation might be our challenge or series of temptations might be our challenge, that they don't even draw on us? There's not even any pull there. There's not any desire at all. That's what we're looking for. God cannot be tempted. That's what we want for ourselves. But God does not himself tempt anyone. God does not do that. Then it says in verse 14, it lays it out as clearly as can be. It is me that is the problem. Verse 14, each one, that's me, that's you, is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. So again, temptation, enticing, provocation, solicitation, they're all interconnected in that way. So I am the problem. There's something wrong inside of me that when these desires are put forth, there's a draw in our human nature toward that sin. Verse 15, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. Now, one thing we learn from that process is that it is a process. Temptation can be fought. Temptation is not sin of and by itself. It is temptation. Sin is birthed from temptation, but it is not sin itself, you see. So the fact that we are drawn toward things that are ungodly is not sin. It's when we yield to those things that sin can be conceived and give birth. So when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. Not something that we want to be a part of. So Satan undoubtedly justifies his enticing of human beings, maybe saying something like this: I didn't cause this person to sin. There's just a few things out there, and they made the choice. So I'm sure, as he's also called the accuser of the brethren, those are the kind of phrases I can imagine him often saying when we fail and we come to God's throne asking for forgiveness. Satan says, wasn't my fault. I can't help it. There's a few things out there that they gave into, you know, men, that beautiful woman, woman, that beautiful man or handsome man, that extra helping of dessert, other than ice cream. The ice cream has no calories. It's okay. But what we see is that temptation puts a mirror in front of us into our character, does it not? And we can see our real character. And we can see the flaws in it. And being tempted does give us an opportunity to come down solidly on the right side, the side of maturity spiritually, of decency, of wisdom, of godliness. So temptation will not disappear from our lives. It gives us the opportunity to do what is right. Now, defeat in the face of temptation sobers us. It shakes us up. It humbles us. Sometimes it can be very discouraging. But it also gives us the opportunity to persevere, to exercise determination, stamina, plain old guts and grit. We're going to fight this problem to the very end. So striving against the shackles of bad habits can make us a far more compassionate individual, a helpful overcomer, we might say. Let's go on to point number two, lest we run out of time and oxygen. Number two, anticipate the future. If we're going to fight temptation, we have to anticipate the future. What's the point of that? Often caving into temptation happens on the spur of the moment. All of a sudden something comes up, it hits us, we jump in without much forethought of where it ends, where it's going. We raise our voice without the thought of how is this going to affect the other person. We type that rant without really realizing what effect is this going to have on others. I'm mad, I'm upset, I'm angry, I'm going to put this on the face, whatever it is, and let the world know. What are the outcomes of that? Sin presents an opportunity to fulfill a lust, and we often head into it without any forethought of where the end result is. And as we began, we said, have you ever found yourself in the rubble of life all of a sudden, having sinned? And how did we get here? What did I do to get ourselves into this situation? So looking ahead to the end result, thinking about it in advance. Notice in Proverbs chapter 6. Proverbs chapter 6. In other words, looking ahead to the conclusion, the end result can be a motivating factor to resist temptation. Carry it out to the worst case scenario as we go forward. Proverbs chapter 6, in verse 25. Now, specifically, Solomon seems to be writing about sexual sin. I think at the same time, while this certainly is true and factual, there's also an aspect here of an allegory, I think, that describes sin in general. So we, as fellows, let's say, should take this both ways, very literally and then figuratively for sin, temptation in general. But Proverbs 6, verse 25 says, lust not after her beauty, the way the King James says. New King James, do not lust after her beauty in your heart. Okay, obviously, what are some of those elements? Human reason, this gal is gorgeous by some standards. Societal standards often are implanted into us very young. Do not lust after her beauty. Look, I'm only looking. There's that aspect of human reason. I'm only looking. It's not that big a deal. Can't you appreciate beauty? Et cetera, et cetera. What's the end result? The end result is either physical or mental adultery. And that leads, of course, to death. So that's the end result. Verse 25, do not lust after her beauty in your heart, nor let her allure you with her eyelids. You see, the eyes say a great deal, do they not? They're the thing that indicates desire and sexiness and all the things that our culture is wrapped up with. Verse 26, for by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and an adulteress will prey upon his precious life. Can a man take fire into his bosom and his clothes not be burned? Look ahead. Where does this lead? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be seared? Well, think about that. Sure, if I run fast enough, my feet aren't going to be burned. Now, human reason, right? I can run fast enough. I've got asbestos fibers in my shirt. I'll be okay. Well, no, we won't. Anyone who's done any baking and put that right or left, in my wife's case, left arm in to grab that pan and just barely touch that rack at 450 degrees or 400 degrees or whatever it is, you don't run fast enough not to be burned, do you? No matter how fast you pull that arm out, you've got the brand, right, for a couple weeks while that burn heals. So no, we can't. Can't take those coals or run over the coals. We can't take them and put them on our clothing or run across. It's just not going to happen. That's his point. So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. Whoever touches her shall not be innocent. You can't get out of that alive, spiritually speaking. It's going to have consequences. So we recognize that in advance, there's a tremendous lie in temptation. It always promises more than it can deliver. It always leaves behind much more complex problems than it claims to be able to solve. Mr. Richard Thompson often taught in his Survey of the Gospels class, one of my mentors in teaching. He said something like this oftentimes: obedience simplifies, sin complicates. It's always true. Obedience simplifies, sin always complicates. Makes things much more difficult. So to be able to look down the road and foresee the consequences that come from giving in to temptation, that temptation at hand, is a great skill to strive to develop with the power of God's Spirit. Help me to see the end result. Where does this lead? Where does this take me? It's good to do this now during the good times. Not struggling with something right now, think about that struggle. Feel like we've overcome something, think about that struggle. How did I start? Where did it start? Last time I sinned in that way, where did it begin? Where did it start? Where did it have its genesis? How do I avoid that in the future? Mr. Armstrong used to say, look to the precursors of sin. What leads up? A precursor is what leads up to the next thing. So what are the precursors to that sin? Look, I lost a lot of sleep. So when I lose a lot of sleep, I get fussy. That's a nice way of saying I can be a real idiot, angry person. Small little things can set me off in a heartbeat, maybe. So we want to think about those things. Look down the road to the consequences. Small decisions can have very large consequences over the course of time. So think about those consequences now of taking that cigarette, of taking that man or that woman, or taking that drug, or eating that food, or expressing that anger. Where does it lead? Anticipate the future. Number three, discipline your feelings. We need to discipline our feelings. Well, what's the point of that? Feelings are a little more dependable than the weather. Will it rain? Will it not? You know, it's interesting that science cannot tell you when it's going to rain, right? They can't. Now, well, you look on your little weather app now, and it says probably about 30% chance of rain right now. That's why do they do that? Because they can't tell you when it's going to rain. It's fickle. All of a sudden, something can, you know, bubble up. And so it's fascinating to watch the weather, let's say, and I haven't now for weeks, but you watch the news and you pick up the weather forecast, and it's always couched. Now, there could be a pop-up thunderstorm here or there. Well, yeah, that's pretty much always the case throughout all history for all eternity. You know, it could get quite gusty. Well, thanks for that information. Could be windy. There's usually wind out there. Then again, I don't mean to tease, but they do the best they can. But feelings are that way. There's nothing dependable about them. Nothing dependable about our feelings. Feelings must flow from right actions and not vice versa. Feelings must flow from right action. let me illustrate. If you wait to get out of bed each morning until you feel like it, how many would have missed services today? Right? Oh, yeah, I just feel like it. Well, no, we control our feelings. One of the fruits, aspects of the fruit of God's Spirit is self-control. And that is controlling our feelings. Well, no, I can't help what I feel. Yes, you can. Yes, I can. There are some feelings that are legitimate, and there are other feelings that are illegitimate. And we must, if I lust after someone else, oh, I feel for that person. There's a song my wife and I grew up with. It's a terrible song. Torn between two lovers. Oh, that's a feeling that is absolutely wrong and sinful. You have to control that. You have to put that into the context of God's law and say, that's wrong. I'm not going to feel that. Well, I can't help what I feel. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Yes, I can. It's a matter of control. It's a matter of discipline. Now, can we always do it well? Do I always do it well? Of course not. But to think that, I just have to give in to my feelings. This person is my soulmate, my heartthrob, my this. It's no. It's giving in to feelings, not the other way around. Our feelings must be subordinate to our will, and our will should be controlled by God's law, by God's way. So feelings, we would say, must be subjugated, brought under proper control. So emotions, feelings, make life much more exquisite than it would be without them, much more so. But they must flow from proper action. I feel great because I, went and served Widow Smith. I feel great because I worked hard for my employer today and earned a good day's wage because I worked hard. I feel great because I finished my Bible study this week, the goal that I had. I feel great because I prayed every day this week the way I felt I should. You see, feelings can come properly from right action. Right action, not the other way around. So rather than living by temporary direction of these inclinations, these impulses, these urges, living a life of wise discipline is very rewarding. Turn to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, beginning in verse 36. It's in the Garden of Gethsemane. Christ is leading up to the most absolutely horrendous experience I suppose anyone could go through, the suffering of the crucifixion and all that led up to it. Noticing his control of feelings in this situation is pretty stunning, pretty inspiring example, very inspiring example. Matthew 26, verse 36, Jesus came with him to a place called Gethsemane. They just finished the Passover service. Said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go and pray over there." He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, James and John, and began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. Sorrowful, that's an emotion. Distress is an emotion. He said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death." Now, did he have reason to feel that way? He knew exactly what was going to be coming. He knew how hard it was going to be, the kind of suffering that we can only imagine. So those were certainly legitimate feelings. "Stay here," he said, "and watch with me." When sometimes brethren are going through sorrowful, distressing circumstances, it's important to stay and watch, to be with them, keep an eye on them, keep in contact. He went a little further, fell on his face and prayed, saying, "Oh, Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." The emotion, "I'd like this to go away." The will, "I will do what you tell me to do." Obviously, subjugating his feelings to his will through the power of God's Holy Spirit, no doubt. Verse 40, "Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, 'What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation.'" Temptation is there. We make the mistake when we enter into it. "The spirit is indeed willing, but the flesh is weak." Lots we could say there. We'll take down to verse 42 now. "Again, a second time he went away and prayed, saying, 'Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass from me unless I drink it, your will be done.'" You see Christ going through this process of subjugating these emotions, the distress, the difficulty. It seemed to be very heavy early, as we read back in verse 36 and 37. And as he goes through, what's he doing? He's in constant contact with God. He's praying to God for subjugation of his emotions in one sense. That's not all he's praying about, but that's one of the things that is the effect of this. So the first time he's saying, "I am deeply distressed, sorrowful." Now they get this second time, and the prayer is a little bit different. "If this cup might not pass away." You see these emotions being garnered, being gathered, being controlled. "Unless I drink it, your will be done." came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them, went away again, and prayed the third time, saying the same words. Can we tell that he got these emotions under control, we might say? Came to the disciples, found them sleeping. Are you still sleeping? Behold, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. There is absolutely no sense at this point of this being deeply distressed and sorrowful. You sense here this steel will, this iron will, that now is the time. He's drawn on the help of God's Spirit. He's drawn on the help of his Father. And he is solidly and stably in control of his emotions. And he is going to do what was required of him. That's an awesome example. So he says, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. What's going on here? Christ is waking up the men so that the first thing that they see when they wake up is not a sword poked in their face, being surrounded by the soldiers. So he wakes them up. Rise, verse 46, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. So he wakes them up. And of course, the clamoring of the swords and the spears and the clubs comes up the hillside to their location. And at this point, the disciples are fully awake. And then he protects them one more time when he asks, who do you seek? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, I am. And they knocks them all over on their backsides. Why? Well, it displays his power, number one. But number two, it gives the disciples a chance to flee. So he's looking out for them. And his emotions are completely in control at this point. That's not to say they were out of control. They were affected by the situation, as ours would be. But by the time he's prayed about it three times, he is solid as a rock, we might say. Not that he wasn't before, but we see the human side of him dealing with this stress. So in the moment of supreme temptation, of extreme emotional pressure to quit, he fought down those temptations to waver or to compromise and went on to face the most brutal death we can imagine with exemplary courage and grace at this point. So we too can rise to the occasion with the help of God's Spirit, praying diligently before God, pouring our souls out to him, having the help of those who might accompany us, help us along the way. We'll talk about that in a moment. But emotion flows out of right action, and it's something to be controlled. Number four, fourth principle, practice replacement. Simple one, you're familiar with it, but a good reminder. Every year we have a solid reminder of the replacement principle, understanding that it's difficult to resist temptation with the action of just, I'm not going to think about that. Put something positive in its place. God tells us to do what? Get rid of unleavened bread. I'm sorry, leavened bread, right? We're told to do that once a year. But he doesn't just say, stop eating. No, you put in the unleavened bread. So if we're going to replace temptation, we often must do so with the action of putting something positive in its place. We are able to make positive changes. No matter how many times we might have floundered or fallen before temptation, we can change. We can draw on the power of God's Spirit to do what is right, replace evil with good. I'll just refer you to Romans 12:21. Be not overcome with evil, but overcome evil how? With good. Overcome evil with good. Can't overcome evil without good. So replacing those things with something good, with something right. In other words, we're too busy serving others. We don't have time. One of the greatest troubles with temptation is excess time. When we talk about the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, it said the extreme idleness was one of the things Ezekiel says was a problem in Sodom and Gomorrah, your sister Sodom, he says. So having time on our hands and nothing good to do is a real problem. So don't be overcome by evil, but overcome that evil with good. Let's go on to the last step, and that is share the load. Share the load. What do we mean by that? Christ took with him Peter, James, and John to the closest place to where he was praying. He just wanted their help. So share your struggles with another trusted confidant, a friend, a counselor. Sharing a trouble can be a great way of help and encouragement. Be careful, of course, with whom you share your deepest struggles. It helps us to have somebody we're accountable to as well. Ecclesiastes 4 gives us the principle. Ecclesiastes 4 in verses 9 through 12. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9. As we were saying earlier, be careful about idle time. Idle time can be a place where we're particularly vulnerable to temptation. So there may be strategies you can use to avoid idle time. Take along reading material, log on to the Life, Hope, and Truth Discern magazine website and listen to podcasts, stay physically active, take a brisk walk, etc., etc. And sharing the load can be a wonderful thing as well. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 9, two are better than one. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. We all know that there are some jobs that are two-man jobs. You need somebody to hold the board while you nail it or screw it, and you've got to take care of this while the other person does that. But then he says this, verse 10, for if they fall, one will lift up his companion. Now, we can think about that in the workplace. It's a two-man job. Can we think about that in the spiritual workplace as well? Sometimes we need someone else to share what we're going through. We need to talk to them about it. Sometimes just the very thing of talking it over with someone else that we trust and that will hold confidences can be a tremendous help in overcoming. The fact that we're able to talk to someone else about it. Verse 10 continues, but woe to him who's alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Certainly physically this is true. I think we should be looking at this spiritually. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? There are some who are self-starters and get busy with things, and there are others who, you know, need a bit of an encouragement. Hey, I'm going to go over and help out Widow Jones or Widow Smith. Can you give me a hand with that? Wow, two are warm together. Great idea. Yeah, I'd be happy to help. So we have the need to share, because temptation often strives to get us off on our own, isolate us from others. That makes it easier for temptation to get its tentacles around us, around our mind, and pull us into sin. So be safe in that sense. Having a support system, even outside the power of God's Spirit, is very, very helpful, very useful. Let's close by turning to Psalm 34. Psalm 34. And we'll read verses 14 and 15. It's part of one of the hymns we regularly sing, so you'll recognize it very quickly. The way it's written in our hymnal is, turn thou from evil and do what is good. Psalm 34 and verse 14. Depart from evil and do good. Again, that replacement principle. If we're going to depart from evil, if we're going to stay away from temptation, we're going to beat down temptation, often it is through doing good. And then it says, seek peace and pursue it. Verse 15, here's the encouraging part. The eyes of the Eternal are on the righteous. God is listening. His ears are open to their cry. Thankfully, God is listening. When we plead with him for strength against temptation, he will answer those prayers. Like Christ praying three times, we can receive strength and steel-willed determination as well. So, brethren, temptation is an active force. It's a power wielded by Satan the devil in an attempt to draw us off task and draw us off into sin. So let's strive to utilize these five defenses. Acknowledge that it's me, anticipate the future, discipline our emotions, practice replacement, share the load, and if we do, we will be successful against temptation. Thank you.